Sounds like a lot of supernatural baloney to me.
Supernatural, perhaps. Baloney, perhaps not. There are many things under the sun.
Welcome to the ClassicHorror.com podcast. I'm your host, Nate Gap. In this, the inaugural edition of our podcast, we'll be looking at the source of the clip from the beginning of the show, Edgar G. Ulmer's The Black Cat from 1934. We'll also be getting completely hysterical about Juan Lopez Moctezuma's 1975 film, Alucarda. All this and more on the ClassicHorror.com podcast. My co-host for this episode is the blogger behind Love Train for the Tenebris Empire, a regular contributor to Ultraviolent Magazine and Nunsploitation.net, and the future ruler of us all, Tenebris Kate. Kate, thanks so much for joining me.
It is a pleasure. I am happy to be your Tenebris co-hostess for this evening, and thank you for the invitation on this inaugural episode of the ClassicHorror.com webcast.
I invite you first to talk about Edgar G. Ulmer's The Black Cat. It's an interesting little film, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think it accomplishes a lot in a really short runtime. It's only 65 minutes on screen, but a lot like Mad Love, also from the same kind of era, also same kind of concise film. It packs a lot of perviness into its runtime.
And because of that, it was really reviled in its original release. I have a couple brief quotes from the time. Variety called it subnormal. Film Weekly called it silly. New York Times called it more foolish than horrible.
You know, I don't think subnormal is necessarily a negative. I mean, I would kind of agree with it, but just the conclusion that they reach, I differ from quite distinctly.
I think Variety's use of subnormal was not our use of subnormal. I think they were talking about the overall quality of the film. This is one of those films that's really benefited from being as old as it is, because we come into it now having seen films where people take a more expressionistic tone and almost Freudian, the house is the villain, like in The Fall of the House of Usher, taking that sort of human drama aspect of a horror, and we've seen a lot more of it since then, so we're able to go back to The Black Cat and say, oh, I see what you did there.
Right. I agree with that entirely. And I think that, certainly it's my feeling that a lot of the horror movies, maybe not the best, because that's a really icky word I like to stay away from, but certainly the ones that I enjoy the most have their feet firmly planted in the surrealist art movement. And I certainly think this is one of those films that has that psychology, that darkness of psychology, and that import of image and the visuals kind of, it's the style over substance thing, you know. It's really a triumph of that, and it's just gorgeous to look at and so creepy, and even upon rewatch it kind of surprises you with the alleys that it's willing to go down. Just fascinating stuff.
Now, I'm going to have to fight you on the style over substance thing, because I think The Black Cat is actually quite a substantive film. You've got this great battle between Herr Polzig, played by Karloff, and Lugosi's character, Vitas Verdegast. And there's this whole, I don't know, I want to call it like a battle of good versus evil, but it's not, because Lugosi's character's not good. You know, he's got that whole gray, totally warped thing going for him. But there's this battle for the soul of that central female character, played by Jacqueline Wells, that I think is, you know, I think the substance is just as much as the style in this film.
That's true. You know, I mean, upon rethink, you got to figure if it was anybody except Lugosi and Karloff in that movie, it would be Fluff, because the set design is just so strong. And the thematic elements are just so left of center, mm-hmm. that if it was any other two actors, you'd really be faced with a situation where it's these two guys kind of like flailing in wacky makeup and set design and shadows and art deco. But, you know, I think they both had, even though it was early in their careers, I think they both had such visual force, as well as force of the way they would speak and the way they would act on screen, that... that carries so much of what happens there.
I was watching Karloff specifically when I rewatched this to prepare, and I love how when we first see him, he's moving very slowly, and he's not saying anything, and Lugosi's doing all the talking, and he's just sort of looking at everything. And then later, after he's sort of kind of figured out what's going on and why Lugosi showed up and what is happening, complete personality change. Suddenly he's very genial, he's very talkative, and he's managed to like put the right emphasis on the right words just so that someone like David Manners, who never has any clue, doesn't have any clue here, and Lugosi knows exactly what he's talking about, and that he's being a sinister creep, which I love.
Oh, absolutely. And there's so much that's handled, I mean, I hesitate to use the word subtle in a movie that's essentially about, you know, Satanism and incest and torture and perhaps even necrophilia. But there is a manner of, like, there's the one scene where the young couple who's stranded now at this beautiful Art Deco keep are getting ready to make love on their honeymoon. And you see Karloff kind of like lurking in the shadows, and he starts caressing this female sculpture in a way that is so provocative and icky. It's just very evocative personality and of that character.
It's really tour de force by Karloff, and I don't want to diss the Lugosi's performance at all, though. I'm not a huge Lugosi fan. This is probably losing me some cred. I think he's I think he's more of a ham than a lot of writers are willing to admit. I think a lot of his power as an actor doesn't come from an actual strong thespianism, and more the fact that he's willing to chew more scenery than the next guy. But in this film, I think it's a bit of a stretch for him, and I think he accomplishes it. I mean, he's got to maintain that balance between someone who is trying to do the right thing for this couple, but also wants to get his revenge on against Karloff.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting that he's playing, for lack of a better term, the protagonist in the movie, even though he's deeply disturbed and there's all this other stuff that happens. And kind of by the end, his actions sort of paint him as being not necessarily the typical hero figure. But, you know, giving him that, there's sort of a breadth to the character that's interesting that he brings to it. And there's still that Dracula kind of delivery that he has throughout. But I think that you expect, you know, you go into a Lugosi film and you want to see him act up and arch the eyebrows and, you know, kind of go down that road. And he's allowed to do that. But I think he's also given enough character material to work with and interesting monologues that he sort of, he plays off of Karloff, who is, I have to agree with you, the stronger actor, but he sort of, you feel like he's reaching towards that. Like he's striving to be the equal and balance out that pairing and not be subsumed under such a cool performance with a great haircut, might I just add.
There's a certain softness actually to his performance in certain areas, especially on the train when he's first meeting the couple, that you don't really see in a lot of his other performances.
Yeah, he, one of my favorite Lugosi performances, I love him in White Zombie.
Where
he's allowed to, yeah, how fantastic is that? And it's interesting to see him, he is definitely, there are moments where he's the opposite of that imperious, hypnotic character, where he has that, as you say, the softness, the vulnerability of person here, which is interesting to see. If not always entirely successful, still very interesting.
And let's just talk briefly about the movie is called The Black Cat, but and it's, you know, suggested by Poe, but there's not a lot that he actually suggests in terms of plot. There's the only thing that's there is that we have a character who's afraid of a black cat who keeps coming back. And it's very minor detail, but it's, but you know, the Poe's not there, and yet it is.
I think I can agree with that.
You know, in the sense that, you know, you've still got the tortured central hero, and you've still got this idea of past transgressions being visited upon, and there's that masochistic, sadomasochistic torture chamber sequence at the end. And yeah, it's one of those things. It's very difficult to nail, but there is definitely Poe in the film.
I think thematically, I think it is a story that Poe would empathize with, because as you say, you know, there are some very sort of late Gothic tropes that Poe certainly were his stock in trade. You have the situation with the obsessive love for the dead woman, and the reincarnation of the woman is there as well. And even the kind of the specter of, you know, the fact that Karloff's character winds up becoming romantically entangled with his stepdaughter, the daughter of this.
How that ever got past character. The censors, I have no idea.
Yeah, it's like, were they asleep at the wheel there or what, man? That was pretty racy, I would say.
I was looking over the censorship history of this movie, and they had some serious issues with the flaying scene. They're like, I don't think there's a way you can do this that's going to get past us, but you're welcome to try. But they just nothing on the step sense. It's just, what the heck?
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost as if these folks who were writing the script threw in the flaying at the end, thinking, God, what's the worst thing we could come up with? Just to throw them off the scent of all the sexual stuff that happens at the beginning of the movie.
Too true, too true. Well, we'll be taking a break right now, but when we come back, we'll start discussing Juan Lopez Moctezuma's Alucarda. So stay tuned to the ClassicHorror.com podcast.
Hi, this is Robert Ring from the Sci-Fi Block. I hope you're enjoying the Classic Horror Podcast. If you find yourself craving some science fiction-related musings after you've gotten your fill of horror commentary, visit us at www.scifiblock.com.
Welcome back to the ClassicHorror.com podcast. My guest is Tenebris Kate from Love Train for the Tenebris Empire. We move now from 1934's The Black Cat up ahead 40 years to 1975's Alucarda.
Satan, 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 our Lord and Master, I acknowledge thee as my God and Prince. I promise to serve and obey thee as long as I shall live. I renounce the other God and all the saints.
Don't listen to them! Satan, don't listen to them!
Our Lord and Master.
Kate, if you'd indulge me, I'd like to... I have a little joke here that I came up with, and I want to apologize to the audience first. Watching Alucarda, I was just thinking to myself, it's like, how much more hysterical can it get? And the answer is none. None more hysterical. Thank you. Thank you.
I cannot resist a nun joke. That is a true statement of scientific fact.
And it's also a true statement of scientific fact that is the worst joke I've ever told about Alucarda. It's also the only joke I've ever told about Alucarda. But this is it's funny that we're starting out with two completely bizarre films, but they're all both bizarre for completely different reasons. Black Cat's kind of got all this weird thematic stuff going around, but it's very kept together in the way it does it. And Alucarda is just balls out crazy.
That is absolutely true. I think another kind of uniting fact about these two films is that one of the things that The Black Cat embraces is it almost puts the Gothic trope into a future. I mean, it's a future that's now past. It was a future in 1934. But Alucarda kind of mashes the 18th century Gothic with its anti-clericalism and kind of almost body horror, reproductive horror kind of themes, and smashes it head on into the 19th century Gothic tradition, which includes, you know, the vampires and a lot of the things that we're more familiar with sort of from a Hammer glamour aspect with being the Gothic. So it's sort of an interesting bridge, if you will, between the two traditions, but batshit crazy. And as such, absolutely wonderful.
I love it. It's a film that I never get tired of watching, and I always discover new things. My most recent rewatch, I discovered that there's this Egyptian Ankh that just shows up on screen for like half a second towards the end. It's like Dr. Osek is calling after his daughter, and then Alucarda is looking at him, and then she runs off screen, and as she's running off screen, just a half second, I had to like freeze frame it. There's this Egyptian white Egyptian Ankh that just shows up in the corner of the screen and then goes away.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. I never even noticed that. But in terms of symbolism, I mean, if you blink, you've missed something. This is just packed to the gills with just a sick kind of beauty of imagery that I think is very in keeping with that Mexican tradition of, you know, highly Baroque imagery and just highly organic and beautiful kind of stuff. You know, it ties in with El Topo and Jodorowsky and all kinds of good, gorgeous Mexican cinema stuff.
It's Which is appropriate because the director was actually an associate of Jodorowsky's. So they met during they met in the Mexican theater, actually. And then I think Moctezuma worked on Fando y Lis and then was credited as an associate producer on El Topo. So the connection's very much there.
Absolutely. It's that Mexican new wave cinema thing. But such is my understanding that Moctezuma was one of the directors, or perhaps the only director of that school, who not only learned from horror, but really embraced horror as his genre and chose to work with it rather than kind of like hunting and plucking different images and repurposing them. So that's kind of interesting.
It's... We were talking in email before this about how much just the amount of screaming in this movie. Nuns scream, kids scream, we all scream for Satan, I guess.
Absolutely. We are just howling mad for the devil and the pleasures of the flesh. It's really kind of a very simple thing. But yes, more loud screaming than any other film, I think, is one of the things that Psychotronic Movie Guide says about this movie. And really, as a jumping off point, if that's going to turn you off, you know, really look elsewhere, because this is one of the loudest. I found myself, you know, I live in an apartment building, and I found myself kind of like hitting the mute button a couple times thinking, please don't call 311 on me. Don't do it. You know, I'm watching an innocent horror film. I'm not torturing young teenage girls today.
And you know, like the Black Cat, of course, there's also this delicious production design, which is as organic in its conception as the Black Cat is, you know, linear and angled. And the earthy colors, the concept of this, the earth, what I love is the way the earthen convent sort of clings to the nuns' terracotta costumes, or whatever you want to call that material. It's not terracotta, but you know what I mean. And it makes it look like they're like doused in blood.
Yeah, the kind of papier-mâché nuns are fascinating. And one of the things that I found interesting rewatching this one again was the fact that you'll see as the movie progresses, even some nuns are cleaner than others. Like some nuns have a lot of kind of bloody effluence on them, whereas others are almost clean. But it always, you know, it's really kind of rather graphic because it always emanates from the center of the body, and it's you know, as a woman, I'm looking at that thinking, you know, certain things are happening to these women, you know, and it's just
certain kind of monthly things.
Certain things. I mean, I'm figuring I'm talking to a mostly male audience here, so I don't want to go down that road too much. But
if they, you know, can't take it, they can't take it.
Yeah, they're in the red tent, okay, guys. But but it's an interesting movie in that way because it's so many of the characters. There are really there are like two male characters in this whole thing, two, three, really, that you see, and it's all women and women's issues and. Well, just kind of an interesting way of playing that up.
You have the father priest guy. You have Dr. Osek. You have the gypsy, who's also played by the same actor who plays Dr. Osek. So I think you have just the two male actors. I think you end up having three male characters, though. But still, yeah, that's just it's very much a women's picture. Whether that's something that's beneficial to the female gender or not, I guess it depends on your outlook.
That is a true statement of fact. it's kind of interesting too that you've got these male figures that are really the authority figures, and then you know, you have the nuns who are kind of fighting on the side of good behavior, if you will, and then these two young women who develop this close friendship, and which has very strong hints that it might be also sexual. And they're kind of fighting on the side of hedonism and self-indulgence under the guise of being satanic. And there's really this battle between everybody in the film. Nobody is a good guy. There are no good guys in this film. If you want to go with the traditionalist view, of course, we have the priest who is fighting for allegedly Jesus and Catholic religiosity. And on the other side, you have the people who are battling for Satan, and so that makes them the bad guys de facto. But if you look at the actual actions of what folks are doing, it's a little more complicated than that.
It's a lot more complicated. Everyone in this movie, at one level, at one point or another, takes on a heroic guise, and at another point in the same movie, these characters all take on a villainous role, or at least a role of uncertain morality. Alucard is... burns nuns alive. Justine rises from a pool of blood. Great shot, by the way. And
yeah, totally awesome moment in film history.
And then just proceeds to chew out the throat of her favorite nun. And then Ossek is like, at first you think Dr. Ossek's going to be the hero. You know, he's the guy who's got science on his side. He's reasonable. You know, he's going to figure it out. And the first minute he sees something he can't explain with science, he becomes a total bastard killer for the side of Jesus.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting that the movie, it sets itself up initially. You think it's going to be similar to Ken Russell's The Devils, where you've got this kind of like triumph of, well, not triumph, but the reasonableness is fighting against the religious, superstitious impulse in humans, and that ultimately Ossek is going to be the guy who comes in and teaches everybody that it's not really the devil, it's multiple personality disorder or whatever, and kind of saves the day in this sort of undercutting way. But when you get into the film, you realize it really is supernatural aspects. They're embracing the supernatural aspects. And furthermore, this priest, who is not necessarily that nice of a guy, is really the one who saves the day, and he is correct. I mean, he saves the day such as it is. You know, everybody kind of ends up worse than they started out, but, you know, just an interesting twist on that, as you say.
And in a lot of circles, this has been sort of elevated as one of the great nunsploitation classics, but it isn't really.
I gotta tell you, you know, as a nunsploitation scientist,
and you have a degree for that?
Count on it, baby. it's the BNA. It's the Bachelorette of Nunsploitation Arts. But you know, while this does have nuns, it is a movie with nuns in it. But in my way of thinking, a nunsploitation movie, you know, proper, really derives its tension from the nuns as like the central image. But I think that Alucarda is a movie, a gothic horror movie that builds the nuns into its storyline, but does not derive the majority of its tension from the fact that they are nuns. It's essentially a movie about these two young women who are allegedly 15, but who appear to be in their mid-20s, if we're judging by the actress's ages, and who form this connection, and it's really almost more of like a Carmilla-type story, but without the vampirism. So while it has that gothic aspect of, you know, the Matthew G. Lewis, the monk, anti-clericalism, it's also got the 19th century gothic stuff of the perverse, quote-unquote, sexuality and lesbianism between these two women. So it's really, while it's certainly a classic movie and certainly something that bears rewatching and is very rich in its symbolism, I really gotta contest the idea of it being the gold standard of nunsploitations.
I absolutely agree with you there. I've never understood people's interpretation of it as nunsploitation. I mean, maybe teensploitation, I guess, but never nunsploitation. The nuns are... my idea of nunsploitation has always been, wow, here are these nuns who are supposed to be really, you know, pious and religious and good, and let's degrade them somehow, you know, or
absolutely. Yeah.
And that doesn't happen here. They're doing what nuns do. They're just doing it in ways that make some real, for lack of a better word, dicks.
I completely agree with you. While the movie has its tendencies of anti-Catholic sentiment, it's not from the nuns acting in non-nunly ways. You're not exploiting that. You're showing nuns being nuns and caring for these orphans in ways that they think are entirely proper. They think that by having this big exorcism and you know, woman strapped to the cross, sticking her with needles, you know, sort of display, that they're doing the right thing for these young girls, even though they're not. But the nuns themselves, it's not an inter-nun conflict. So, sorry guys, I gotta explode the nunsploitation myth on ya. I really have to pull that carpet out from under ya.
But hey, even without that, there's still a lot of very vivid religious commentary. I think my favorite line in the entire film comes from the father Lazaro or whatever his name is. Mm-hmm. And he says, "That's a type 7 heliophobic demon. Like, this isn't a big important revelation. Like, oh my god, it's a level 7.
Absolutely. It's like you have to roll a natural 20 to defeat it. And then everybody sort of reacts to that as if they know exactly what he's talking about. That's the brilliant part of that scene is not only his security in making this statement, but everyone else's reaction of, god damn it, he's right. He's a genius for noticing this.
And it makes you think, who's taking the time to take all these demons that are obviously out there in the world and put them into various levels? And then who else is taking the time to learn all the levels?
You know what? I think they're making it up. And frankly, I think we're both in the wrong line of work. That's my call on the matter.
Seriously, we should be like demon librarians.
Absolutely.
Classified.
Count on it, man. And like, how mad does it make you in this world that we don't live in some place at least as awesome looking as that convent? How cool is that convent to look at?
I don't know. That convent actually creeps me the hell out. I mean, just all those crucifixes in the chapel just looming at you. It's just overwhelming you with sacrifice and blood and
I love
nails.
The fact that one of the things that's interesting about that image to me is that you have the central Christ on a crucifix, you know, as we know it, and then you have all these echoes in the rock behind it. So it's almost a play on the idea of Catholicism as being this sort of polytheistic, almost paganistic religion, you know, with all these multiple representations of the God figure. Just really interesting stuff.
That's not something I'd actually thought about. So good on you. Wow. Also, that crypt, that brilliant crypt that's just, you know, covered in cobwebs and vines, and that central casket in the center from which horrible things arise late in the film. I love the design of that. It's just so striking, just the way it's
laid out. And I love the fact that Alucarda is a movie that gives you just enough explanations to keep the plot moving, but leaves enough doors open for interpretation. Like, why is there this castle vault that exists somewhere in the woods? And where are we? Are we in Middle Europe? Are we in South America? You know, it's this sort of dreamlike atmosphere, and it really enhances that. You know, those red drapes that you have that look like they might be cloth or they might be some kind of paper mache. Just really... it's very vivid, but very simple at the same time. It's drawing on things that we've seen before, but recombining them in ways that make it feel fresh or scary or evocative in some way.
Yeah, I definitely go with evocative on that one. There's so much more to talk about. I mean, you could talk about the fact that, you know, blood and boobs wise, it's,
yeah, I mean,
at
it,
the top
it, it really
of the charts.
Goes to full-on Euro trash levels, even though it's, I guess technically it's North America trash, really. I mean, if it's made in Mexico, but definitely has that kind of that feel of like you're seeing the unedited version, the X-rated version. It really has a sexual feel without being sexy, which is kind of strange.
Oh yeah, the blood doesn't come in your normal fashion either. It's like there's that scene where the one sister in the convent is, I don't know, telepathically channeling her will to strike down the gypsy woman, and her face becomes spattered in this blood, and it's freakish because she looks so happy through all the blood at the end. Just be typical.
Absolutely. I think it's an interesting, like almost like stigmatic kind of thing that's happening to her that you get, like the sort of like padre.
Yes, stigmatic. That's the word I wanted.
You can have it. You can say it. But it's almost like this kind of Padre Pio suffering through, through the suffering and through the bloodiness and horror. And one of the interesting things about that scene to me, because I really do feel like Moctezuma kind of incorporates this parallelism between the paganism of the gypsies and the sort of idolatry of the Catholics. There's this really interesting thing that happens in that scene where her expressions are mirroring the ecstatic expression on the pagan people who were going through this celebration of, I guess, it's like the wedding. Between watching her face kind of contort in the same ways that the gypsy's face is, even as she's causing her untimely demise, is just an interesting thing. I think that was handled really well.
And, you know, I never noticed that, so... Again, good on you. I must have seen this movie 3 or 4 times, and it's just, yeah, there's things like that I still haven't discovered.
It's only 70 minutes long. It's just jam-packed with just so much interesting stuff. Depending on where you choose to kind of cast your eyeballs, there's plenty for you to work on. I mean, it's total thesis time stuff.
Yeah. It's also one of those movies, unfortunately, that you can only really recommend to friends that you already know or sort of dig the exploitation vibe, because it doesn't operate on the same sort of rules as normal cinema. I mean, it constantly changes its mind whether it's from an objective or subjective viewpoint. So really, you got to be careful who you recommend it to.
I'd say that about almost every movie that I've enjoyed is like I have a standard disclaimer that comes with my movie recommendations. You know, it's like I really dug this, but you know, keep in mind I went to art school. You know. Not your mileage may vary. Like, why MMV is like appended to pretty much every opinion I have on certainly film, because I like movies. I respond really well to movies that exist in sort of the hinterland between the art house, you know, the very deliberate art. I'm making an artistic statement with this capital A, and movies that are just purely cash in exploitational. You know, melodramas. And I think Alucarda just really crystallizes that. You know, somebody who was fascinated by the idea of using the tropes of the horror world, but really applying them to this maybe a little bit higher, a little bit more surrealistic, artistic kind of universe. So it's just a really fascinating film.
And it's one of my favorites. And yeah, this comes as a... This is actually the second time I've looked at the film. I have a review up on classichorror.com. And, you know, it still comes with a hearty recommendation. And part of the reason I invited Kate to do this is that she has so far refused to a review on her own blog. So this is my way of getting hers out of her.
Yeah, he applied the thumb screws. It was really terrible.
Oh, yeah, you hated it.
It was
terrible. Kate, I'd like to thank you for joining us for our very first podcast. It's been awesome talking to you about these two films.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the invitation, Nate.
All right. You can catch more of Kate's opinions at tenebriskate.blogspot.com. That link is available on the podcast information page. Well, that's all we have here for the ClassicHorror.com podcast. This is Nate Yap saying, horror matters.